Why do you fight it? Adam had asked him angrily on more than one occasion. Why can you not glory in what you are and enjoy the power of being Sersin Brody? You possess the ability to give and take more pleasure than most mortals ever know. Soar, Sersin, drink of the life of my kind. I offer you it freely. Not freely, Sersin scoffed. There was a price. He squeezed his eyes shut as the music thundered in his ears. It was his fate that she would ride like a mighty, demanding Valkyrie upon his body. She already sang like a siren to his heart, this woman of defiance and fear, of curiosity and contradiction. Naya had been soft and passive toward her lot in life, until the end when she'd turned bitter. Never before had he met a woman like Lisa, a woman with needs and desires and a mind of her own. Deep emotions roiled in her breast, cunning intelligence glowed in her eyes, and a fierceness that vied with the legendary Valkyries breathed in her veins. Rules be damned. How could he argue with the future? It was written. He could only take it, enjoy it, and make the most of it, praying he would survive it when he lost his heart to her, then inevitably lost her in a short span of years. If he was going to be mad in the future, he may as well savor the present. Sersin Brody rose from his chair, ripped the machine from the future off his head, and did what he'd never dare do before. He eased his control a tiny bit and encouraged the magic to throb inside him. Dark Angel, Adam had inveigled him, soar into my world and fear nothing. He tossed back his head and tasted the power running through his formidable body. It was a very different creature who left the dark, hidden room to find his woman. Adam Black smiled as he removed the tampon from the barrel of the rifle. Although Sersin had refused to use any of the weapons Adam had brought him, the warrior within him could not permit time to tarnish them. He snorted, dangling the tampon from its string. Only his fastidious Sersin Brody would decide that the soft white swabs were to be used for cleaning. Eyeing the rifle, Adam grinned. They were the perfect size to slip inside the barrel. It nearly seemed sensible. But he hadn't brought tampons back to medieval Scotland for Sersin to play with. He'd brought them, and every gift he'd chosen, for another reason. Although if he had his way, there would be many nine-month intervals during which she would have no use for them. Chapter 15.
You're a beauty, lass,
Galindria said, clapping her hands.
I thought I could refashion it well, but 'tis the woman who makes this gown.
Lisa stood before the mirror, gazing at herself with no small measure of shock. Galindria had refitted a dress that she said had belonged to Sersin's mother, Morgana. Now she slipped it over her shoulders, atop a shift of softest linen. Midnight blue silk clung to her breasts, and the scooped neck slipped off her shoulders, accentuating her translucent skin and fine collarbones. It hugged her hips and fell to the floor in a rustle of blue embroidered with gold. At her waist, Galindria had fastened a gold girdle that knotted low and from which hundreds of tiny gold moons and stars dangled. Matching slippers encased her feet, and a lovely gold torque that predated medieval times encircled her throat. An embroidered surcoat was tied below her breasts. Galindria had curled her hair, carefully picking out the gold highlights and curling them a bit tighter, so that they lay atop the wavy mass, then mussed it gently. A dab of some combination of root, herb, and flower colored her lips ruby. Who was this woman in the mirror who looked like sin? She wondered. Like sins, she amended fancifully, for even she had to admit that the woman in the mirror now looked a suitable companion for the laird of the castle. For once, she didn't curse herself for being tall, because in this gown her height added an unmistakable touch of elegance.
You're incredible, Galindria,
Lisa breathed.
I am, aren't I?
Galindria replied without a trace of arrogance.
Although I have not had a woman with your perfect figure to clothe for some time, I have not forgotten how. The Laird will be well pleased.
Lisa was well pleased. She'd never known she could look like this. At 17, she'd hoped one day to look like Catherine, a golden, striking beauty. But work had become all-consuming as she'd struggled to provide for her mother, and Lisa hadn't spared another thought for her own appearance in 5 long years. Her mother would love...
Oh, Mom.
She shivered. How could she have forgotten even for an instant?
Are you cold, m'lady?
Galindria asked.
I can fetch a wrap.
Nay,
Lisa said softly.
Just a momentary chill, nothing more. Go on with you now, Galindria. I'll find my way to the Great Hall.
After Galindria left, Lisa sank down on the bed. Castle Brody was the loveliest place she'd ever been, and there she sat in a dress made for a princess, about to have dinner with a man who was the stuff of her every romantic dream. For a few minutes, she'd forgotten all about Catherine. She'd been too busy experiencing all the anticipation and excitement of a woman preparing for a special date. But this was no date, and there would be no happily ever after. Her mother needed her desperately, and Lisa was doing something she had never before permitted herself to do. She was failing to carry out her responsibilities to Catherine. Failure was not a thing to which she was accustomed. She'd always been able to work harder, or for longer hours, to ensure, if not success, at least safety, food, and a roof over their heads. She had no right to feel even a brief moment of happiness, she admonished herself, until she found the flask and established her way home.
And then will you feel happy, Lisa?
Her heart asked gently.
When you leave him and go home to sit at your mother's bedside? When she's gone and you are left alone in the 21st century, will you be happy then?
Her resolve to feel no pleasure lasted all of an hour. Lisa finished her dessert and sighed contentedly. If she'd learned nothing else, she'd learned to appreciate the good things that were interspersed with the bad, and dinner had been the best. The formal dining hall was beautiful, lit by dozens of candles. She was warm, clean, and full. For the first time since she'd been in the 14th century, she'd eaten a splendid meal. Admittedly, her meals back in her century had never been 7 courses of heaven, but even White Castle hamburgers fared well against the bland, tough meat and hard bread to which she'd been subjected. During the past few weeks, she'd despaired of ever eating a decent meal again. 20 feet of table separated them, like in the old movies, she thought. She needed 20 feet between her and the Lord of Brody Castle. They dined mostly in silence, and he'd been the epitome of a gracious host. He hadn't scowled at her even once. In fact, several times she'd caught him regarding her with an admiring gaze. His previous bad temper seemed to have melted away without a trace, and he appeared as close to relaxed as she'd ever seen him. She wondered what had changed his mood. Perhaps he was going to war soon, she decided, which would suit them both fine. He'd get to throw his weight around, being the brash, overbearing male, and she'd be free to tear the castle apart from top to bottom in search of the flask, without fear of his watchful gaze. He certainly wouldn't carry such a valuable relic into battle. He'd have to leave it here somewhere. The idea made her feel positively magnanimous. She glanced at him, feeling secure in the distance between them, and smiled.
Thank you,
she murmured. For what, lass? He idly licked a swirl of fluffy topping from his spoon.
For feeding me,
she replied, assuring herself that the mere glimpse of his tongue flicking over a spoon was not sufficient cause for her blood pressure to rise.
I've fed you every day since you've been here, and you've not thanked me before,
he observed mockingly.
That's because you never fed me anything worth eating before.
She watched as he licked a dab of cream from the tip of his spoon.
I think you got it all,
she said uneasily. Suddenly the cavernous room seemed to shrink, and she felt as if she were sitting mere inches away from him, not 20 feet. And who had poked up the dratted fire? She fanned at her face with a hand that betrayed not the slightest tremor she was feeling.
Got what all?
He asked absently, filling his spoon with a mound of berries and cream.
How is this topping made?
She asked, changing the subject swiftly.
Much like butter. You churn it with paddles or shake it in a jug. It is merely cream skimmed from the top of milk, mixed with sugar and a touch of cinnamon. It thickens as you paddle it and add the sweetening. I used to watch them make it when I was a lad, flattering cook and anyone else in the kitchen to get my hands on it.
Whipped cream in the 14th century, she marveled. She wondered how many things these barbarians had that modern scholars never discussed. But why wouldn't they have such condiments? In the few days she'd been in Castle Brody, she'd noted many things that surprised her. It all just seemed too civilized. She fixed her gaze on her plate, trying to prevent herself from rising from her chair, taking his spoon away, and giving him something else to lick. Her finger, her lower lip, the hollow of her spine. Although she'd had little experience with men, she was innately sensual, and she'd fantasized often, perhaps more than most, because she'd tasted so little of sexuality. Tonight, with this magnificent warrior dining regally at the end of the table, her imagination took flight. In her fantasy, he walked to her end of the table, capturing and holding her gaze with that subtle magnetism he had. His eyes were heavy-lidded, banking a challenge.
Become a woman, Lisa.
He took her hand, pulled her to her feet, and kissed her, a soft brush of his lips, a quick velvety stroke of his tongue, promising so much more, slipping deep into her mouth when her lips parted on a sigh. Her fantasy picked up speed, fast-forwarded abruptly to his pressing her back onto the table, slipping the gown from her body, dropping whipped cream on her breasts, and licking it from her moist, warm skin with the same careful deliberation he'd given his spoon. Perhaps a dab of warm, rich cream would inadvertently fall where she'd touched herself before, and with his lips he would... Swallowing hard, she looked at him. He raised his eyes from the frothy concoction on his spoon at the precise moment she looked up, and their gazes locked over the length of the polished wood table.
Where would you drip whipped cream on him, Lisa?
The answer came with frightening swiftness and conviction. Everywhere. She wanted to explore his body, the hard ripples, the smooth skin. The candlelight bathed his olive skin with a golden hue, and his dark good looks were set off perfectly by his linen shirt and the splash of black and crimson draped across his chest. He was mesmerizing.
Are you hungry, lass?
He licked his spoon languidly. She couldn't tear her gaze away.
No, I've eaten quite enough,
she managed.
You seem to be watching my dessert most intently. Are you certain there isn't something else you wish to sate your appetite?
Besides you, to remove your clothing, lie on the table, and let me finger-paint you with whipped cream, you mean?
She thought.
Nope,
she said casually.
Not a thing.
She watched him for a moment. He still had a great deal of dessert left. How was she going to get through this?
Actually,
she said, leaping to her feet,
I'm exhausted. And would like to retire.
He dropped his spoon and moved swiftly to her side.
I will escort you to your chambers,
he murmured, taking her arm and tucking it into his. Lisa shivered. The man was throwing off the heat of a small forge. His scent enveloped her, faint but spicy. It was a fragrance she couldn't quite put her finger on. She was certain she'd smelled it before, but couldn't figure out where. It was definitely a unique scent, one that modern-day perfumers would have killed to get their hands on.
I can walk by myself perfectly well,
she said, removing her arm from his.
As you wish, Lisa.
he replied easily. Her eyes narrowed.
Why are you suddenly being so nice to me? I thought you were angry with me. I thought you didn't want to marry me. I thought you thought I was a spy.
He shrugged innocently.
First, I've always been reasonably pleasant to you. Second, I don't have any choice but to marry you. And third, marrying you renders distrusting you obsolete. I am a logical man, lass. When a warrior realizes he has only one course of action, he makes the best of it. Anything else would be foolish. That doesn't mean that I don't still have many questions. I plan to learn everything about you, lass, he said meaningfully. But I am no longer going to fight my situation. Not one bit of it, he added silently. Not my magic, not my dark side, not my adherence to rules. I am a new man, Lisa Stone, he told her inside his head, and it felt good. Never before had he accepted any portion of what he considered his dark side, but never before had he been so tempted by a woman to do so. He had a feeling that a man might need a little magic to woo and win Lisa Stone. They ascended the stairs in silence. He smiled, thinking he'd finally managed to still her acerbic tongue merely by being as nice to her as he'd wanted to be, but, constrained by his oath and his rules, had resisted. She would encounter no further resistance from him. At the door to her chambers, she stopped and looked up at him. He was pleased by her action, for it told him clearly that she desired his kiss, and he planned to give her much more than a kiss before the night was through. Chapter 16. Lisa waited, cursing herself silently. During the walk to her chambers, she'd thought of a dozen excuses to escape him and flee to her room alone, but one thing had prevented her. She wanted a goodnight kiss. Dinner had been perfect, and she wanted to end it like a real date, with a real kiss. So she faced him, and turned her face up expectantly. But he neither kissed her, nor left her there. Rather, he reached around her to the door, pushed it open, and smoothly backed her into the room.
"What are you doing?"
she asked uneasily.
"I thought merely to visit with you a while, lass."
"I don't think that's a good idea," she said. "You may bid me good night now."
Her fantasy was too fresh in her mind. She wanted a simple kiss to dream on, not the whole man. She couldn't handle the entire man.
"Why, do I make you uncomfortable, lass?"
He stepped farther into the room and closed the door behind him.
"Of course not," she lied,
moving away from him quickly.
"Infuriate me? Frequently."
She suddenly realized she was pacing and forced her feet to still.
"I just don't see any reason for you to be in my chambers. Go!"
She waved her hand at him. He laughed, a husky rumble.
"I think you find being in a room with me and a bed disturbing."
Lisa moved swiftly to the plump mattresses and plunked herself upon them defiantly.
"No, I don't. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. It's simply that I'm tired and would like to sleep."
She yawned hugely.
"Quite a yawn. Lovely pink tongue, by the way. Do you recall how it feels when yours jousts with mine? I haven't forgotten. I want more."
Despite her resolve not to, she looked at him, fascinated.
"I want your tongue in my mouth."
She averted her gaze with effort.
"I want mine all over your body."
Lisa swallowed.
"I am not interested," she said faintly.
"Don't you lie to yourself, Lisa. Don't lie to me. You want me. I can feel it in the air between us. I can smell it."
Lisa didn't dare breathe. She harbored an absurd hope that he would just leave after declaring that truth, and not force her to confront the enormity of it. She did want him, desperately. Fantasies collided in her mind, daring her to relinquish her innocence and embrace womanhood. He moved slowly toward her and sat on the edge of her bed. She scooted back hastily, her back flushed to the headboard, and hugged a pillow to her chest.
You enjoy looking at me, Dona Yulisa.
She enjoyed doing more than looking at him. She liked fighting him with her kisses, tasting the salt and honey of his skin. With deft fingers, he untied the laces of his linen shirt and shrugged it off over his head. The muscles in his abdomen rippled, the curves of his biceps flexed.
Then look, he said, his voice rough. Look your fill. Think you I do not recall how you gazed at me in my bath?
When his wide shoulders were revealed, she shook her head and sucked in a breath.
Stop that! What are you doing?
Lisa exclaimed. Lounging at the foot of her bed was 6 feet 7 inches of dark, seductive man, with rippling muscles beneath bronzed skin. A warrior, in every sense of the word. Fine black hair dusted his powerful chest and thick forearms. A finer trail of hair skittered down his abdomen and crept beneath the brilliant red and black tartan knotted at his waist. All in all, Sersin Brody was the most desirable man Lisa had ever seen.
Use me, Lisa, he encouraged softly. Take whatever you want.
When she made no reply, he said,
You have never been with a man, have you?
Lisa smoothed the coverlet, her mouth dry. She had no intention of discussing this with him. She wet her traitorous lips and was appalled when they parted and said,
Is it so apparent?
To me, perhaps not to other men.
Why?
You are old enough to have been with many men. You are beautiful enough that many must have tried. Did you find none to your liking?
Lisa hugged the pillow tighter. In high school, she'd had several boyfriends, but they'd always seemed so immature to her. Catherine said it was because she was an only child, that she was more accustomed to being around adults. She'd suspected her mom was right.
Did I take you from someone? A lover, perhaps?
A muscle twitched in his jaw.
No. There's been no one.
I find that difficult, nay, impossible to believe.
Trust me,
Lisa said with a self-deprecating laugh.
Men, we're not exactly beating down my door.
If they had been, they would have fled shortly after gaining entrance and discovering her financial straits and her caretaker role.
Ah, perhaps they were afraid of you, because you are so much woman.
I am not fat,
Lisa bristled.
I'm healthy,
she supplied defensively. Sersin smiled.
That you are, but that is not what I meant.
Well, I'm not too tall. A giantess wouldn't be too tall for you.
At 5 feet 10, she had towered over many of the boys in her class until the last 2 years of high school.
Not what I meant either.
Then what did you mean?
She asked, feeling wounded.
You are smart.
No, I'm not,
she said, thinking.
Anything but smart.
Yes, you are. You were smart enough to realize it would be foolish to escape me at Dunatar, and clever enough to deduce a way out of my chambers. Aye, even fearless enough to dare it. Tell me, do you read and write?
Yes.
Inwardly, Lisa glowed. She was smart in the 14th century.
You are persistent, tenacious, determined, strong. You do not need anyone, do you?
I haven't had the opportunity to need anyone. Everyone's always been too busy needing me,
she muttered, then felt guilty for voicing her most secret resentment.
Need me, Lisa.
She searched his face. What had changed him? Why was he acting this way? It was as if he genuinely cared and sincerely desired her.
Need me, he repeated firmly. Use me to explore the woman who has never been given the opportunity to live. Take from me, need from me, and satisfy all that curiosity I feel burning in you. And by Dagda, let go of that maidenhead. Do you wish to live and die, never having known passion? Never having tasted what I offer you? Be bold. Take. He uttered the last word in a low, masculine tone. Take. The word lingered in her mind. It was almost as if it had rolled from his tongue imbued with some kind of sorcery. What would it be like to take, as he said it, to utterly consume without guilt or fear? Take, because her blood demanded it, because her body needed it. Lisa's lips parted as she contemplated his words. His upper torso was a vast expanse of olive skin that would be velvety to the touch. Her fingers ached to trail over the hard ridges of his chest, to linger over his shoulders, to curve around his powerful neck and drag him into a kiss that would make her forget where he began and she ended.
I thought you medieval men prized virginity. Don't you think it's wrong for a woman to have her own desires and act on them?
Your virginity is a piece of skin, a membrane, Lisa. My first love was long ago, and it has not changed who I am in any fashion. Mind you, I am not saying you should give the gift of lovemaking to just anyone. But an obsession with virginity is absurd and serves no purpose but to make a woman turn away from a fine part of her nature. Women and men have the same desires. At least they do until the priests have their go at the women and convince them it is shameful. What the priest should be saying is, choose well.
How many...
She broke off quickly. What a stupid question to ask. She would sound like a childish, possessive adolescent. But she wanted to know. It said something about the man. A man who'd been with hundreds of women had a real problem, as far as she was concerned.
7.
His teeth flashed white against his face.
That's not very many. I mean, for a man, you know,
she added hastily. What would she think if she knew it was only 7 in 500 years? Thousands of times with those 7. Enough to know well how to please any woman, but only 7 all the same.
Each woman was a country, rich and lush as Scotland, and I loved them with the same dedication and thorough attention I give my homeland. I confess, the first few were naught but the man and me celebrating life when I was less than a score of years. But the last two were wonderful women, both friends and lovers.
Then why did you leave them?
A shadow crossed his beautiful face.
They left me, he said softly. Died, he thought, too young in a land too harsh.
Why?
Lisa, touch me.
He moved closer, close enough that she could smell the spice of his skin. Close enough that she could feel the heat radiating from his body, mingling with the heat from hers. Close enough that his lips were a breath and a yes away from hers. Tempting, more compelling than her need for basic survival. Fingers extended, she reached for him, but at the last moment she dropped her hand, forming a fist in her lap. He was silent for a long moment.
You aren't ready yet. Very well. I can wait.
He rose in a fluid motion. As he stood, the knot on his tartan slipped, and the fabric dropped lower on his hips, giving her a sinful glimpse of what she was denying herself. Her gaze fixed on the black trail of hair that fanned below his belly button, then dropped lower to the thicker hair that peaked above the tartan. The sight of it gave her a heavy feeling in the pit of her stomach, an awful, empty pressure. Whether he moved or the plaid slid, she didn't know, but suddenly it dipped lower, revealing the thick base of his shaft amid silky dark hair. She couldn't see the length of it, but that wasn't what made her heart pound. It was the thickness of him. She would never be able to wrap her hand around it. What would it feel like to have him push that inside her? Her mouth went dry. His eyes lit appreciatively as her gaze snagged there.
I could pick you up and wrap those lovely long legs of yours around my waist, slip deep inside you, rock you against me and love you till you lay in my arms and slept like a babe. I will spend each night stretched beside you, teaching you what you want me to teach you. I can feel that you want it from me. Yet, it will be at your pace, when you choose. I will wait as long as I must. But know this, Lisa. When you are across the dinner table from me on the morrow, in my mind, I am pushing you back on a bed. In my fantasy. He laughed, as if at his own brashness. You are discovering yourself with my willing body. Who knows, perhaps even laying siege to the heart that beats within this chest. He thumped his chest with a fist, and silently admitted she'd already begun to do that. Otherwise he wouldn't have offered himself. But she didn't need to know that. He knotted the tartan slowly, never taking his eyes from hers. Good night, Lisa. Sleep with the angels. Her eyes stung from quick tears. It had been her mother's nightly benediction. Sleep with the angels. But then he added words her mother never had. Then, come back to earth and sleep with your devil, who would burn in hell for one night in your arms. Wow! Was all her reeling mind could come up with as he slipped from the room.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Highlander's Touch by Karen Marie Monning, performed by Phil Giganti. Chapter 17. 3 days had passed since their first dinner in the formal dining room. That was 72 hours. 4,320 minutes, and Lisa had felt each one of them whiz past her, gone forever. 9 shifts of nurses had changed at home. 9 meals had been taken by her mother. Bland food, she was certain, no ripe plums and apricots carefully selected from the market on her lunch hour. Illness had changed Catherine's appetite, and she developed a craving for fruits. Lisa had spent the days snooping as furtively as possible, but she had begun to suspect it was futile. She didn't have the first idea where to look for the flask. She'd tried his chambers several times during the day, but the door was always locked. She'd even gone to the turret to the left of his chambers to see if there was a way she could manage to scale the outside wall to get there, but it was hopeless. His chambers were on the 2nd floor of the east wing, and there were guards on the battlements above it at all times. She'd passed the evenings indulging herself in offensively sumptuous meals. Last night, the first course had been a mixture of plums, quince, apples, and pears, with rosemary, basil, and rue in a pastry tart. The second course had been a chopped meat pastry. The third, an omelet with almonds, currants, honey, and saffron. The fourth, roasted salmon in onion and wine sauce. The fifth, artichokes stuffed with rice. By the honey-glazed chicken rolled in mustard, rosemary, and pine nuts, she'd been wallowing in guilt. By the berry pastries with whipped cream, she despised herself. And each night, he'd savored his dessert with the same lazy sensuality that made her long to be a berry or a fluff of topping. She couldn't fault his demeanor. He'd been an impeccable dinner companion and host. They'd made cautious small talk. He'd told her of the Templars and their plight, spoke of their training, and extolled the strengths of his Highland fortress. She'd asked about his villagers, whom he seemed to know surprisingly little about. He'd asked about her century, and she'd made him talk about his instead. When she'd asked about his family, he'd turned the tables and asked about hers. After a few moments of strained evasions, they'd mutually conceded to leave each other alone on that topic. He seemed to be going out of his way to be gracious, patient, and accommodating. In turn, she'd been carefully reserved, finding an excuse each night to dash from the table after the final course and hole up in her room. He permitted her escape, for the price of a tantalizing kiss each night at her door. He had not tried again to enter her chambers. She knew he was waiting for her invitation. She also knew she was perilously close to extending it. Each night it was more difficult to find a reason not to take what she so desperately desired. After all, it wasn't as if letting him spend one night in her bed would have the same effect as Persephone eating 6 seeds in Hades. Her problem was twofold. Not only was she losing precious time and getting no closer to finding the flask, but she was beginning to adapt in insidious little ways. The immediacy of her presence in 14th-century Scotland seemed to be sapping her resolve. She'd never had a time in her life that was so peaceful, so filled with idle time, so safe. No one was relying on her. No one's life would fall apart if she caught a bad cold and was unable to work for a few days. No bills were pressing. No deep blanket of gloom encompassed her. She felt like such a traitor. Bills were pressing. Someone was relying on her. And she was helpless to do a damn thing about it until she found that flask. She sighed, wishing fervently that she had something to do. Work would be cathartic. Immersing herself in physical duties was the only way she'd ever managed to keep her demons at bay. Perhaps she could help a few of the maids, insinuate herself into their confidence, and learn more about the laird and his customs, like which were his favorite rooms, where he stored his treasures. Leaping from her perch in the window seat in the study, she went off, determined to track down a job for herself.
"Galindria, wait!"
Lisa called as the maid hurried down the corridor.
"Milady?"
Galindria paused and turned, her arms heaped with bed linens.
"Where are you going?"
Lisa asked, catching up. She extended her hands to relieve a portion of Galindria's burden.
"Here, let me help you carry some of those."
The maid's face was half hidden behind the mountain of linens, but what Lisa could see of it was quickly transformed by an expression of horror. Her blue eyes widened, her dark brows flew up, and her mouth parted in a gasp.
"Milady, these are soiled!"
Galindria exclaimed.
"Well, that's all right. You're doing wash today. I can help,"
she said cheerfully. Galindria skittered back.
"Nay, the laird would banish me."
She turned and scurried down the hall as quickly as she could beneath the towering pile of linens.
"Heavens,"
Lisa thought.
"I was only trying to help."
After searching for half an hour, Lisa found the kitchen. It was as splendid as the rest of the castle, spotless, efficiently designed, and currently occupied by a dozen servants preparing the afternoon meal. Buzzing with conversation, warmed by melodic laughter, the kitchen was made even cozier by a brightly leaping fire, over which sauces simmered and meats roasted. The flames hissed and flickered as basting juices drizzled onto the logs. She smiled and called a cheery hello. All hands stilled. Knives stopped dicing in mid-slice, brushes stopped basting, fingers stopped kneading dough. Even the dog curled on the floor near the hearth dropped his head on his paws and whimpered. As one, the servants sank low in deference to her station.
"Milady,"
they murmured nervously. Lisa studied the frozen tableau for a moment, struck by the absurdity of the situation. Why hadn't she anticipated this? She knew her history. No one in the castle would permit her to labor, not the kitchen staff, not the laundress, not even the maids dusting the tapestries. She was a lady, and a lady was to be kept, not to keep. But she didn't know how to be kept. Depressed, she mumbled a courteous goodbye and fled the kitchen. Lisa sank into a chair by the hearth in the great hall and indulged herself in a serious brood. She had two things with which to occupy her mind, her mother and Sirsin. Both were dangerous, although for vastly different reasons. She was considering cleaning out the hearth and scrubbing the stones when Sirsin entered. He glanced at her. "Lass," he greeted her, "have you had breakfast?"
"Yes,"
she replied with a dejected sigh. "What's amiss?" he asked.
"I mean, other than the usual, that which is always amiss with you. Perhaps I shall preface each conversation we have by assuring you that I still cannot return you. Now, what has you looking so glum so early on a fine Highland morn?"
"Sarcasm does not become you," Lisa muttered.
He bared his teeth in a smile, and although she kept her face inscrutable, inwardly she sighed with pleasure. Tall, powerful, and utterly gorgeous, he was a vision a woman could get used to seeing first thing in the morning. He was wearing his tartan and a white linen shirt. His sporran was buckled around him, accentuating his trim waist and long, muscled legs. He'd just shaved, and a bit of water glistened on his jaw. And he was huge. She liked that. A mountain of masculinity.
"What do you expect me to do with myself, Sirsin Brody?"
she asked irritably. He was very still. "What did you call me?" Lisa hesitated, wondering if the arrogant man could really expect her to call him M'lord, even after he'd offered himself to her a few nights ago. Fine, it would keep things impersonal. She rose and bowed sweepingly.
"My lord,"
she purred.
"Sarcasm does not become you. That is the first time I've heard my name on your lips. As we are to be wed, you must use it henceforth. You may call me Sin."
Lisa blinked at him from her servile position. Sin. That he was. And that was the bulk of her problem. If he were not so irresistible, she wouldn't feel so alive around him. Ergo, she wouldn't constantly feel so guilty about her mom. Had he been an unattractive, spineless, stupid man, she would have felt miserable every minute of the day, and that would have been acceptable. She should be miserable. She had abandoned her own mother, for heaven's sake. Her back stiffened, and she stood up straight.
"Perhaps I should preface each of our conversations as well, by reminding you that I won't be marrying you, my lord."
A corner of his mouth quirked.
"You are truly possessed of a streak of defiance, aren't you? What did the men in your time make of it?"
Before she could answer, Duncan came bounding into the hall, followed by Galen.
"Morning all, and a fine day it is, eh?"
Duncan said brightly. Lisa snorted. Couldn't the handsome Highlander be pessimistic just once?
"Sirsin, Galen was down in the village early this morning, hearing some of the disputes that have backed up in the manor courts."
"Isn't the Lord supposed to decide those?"
Lisa asked acerbically. Sirsin's gaze shot to her.
"How would you know that? And what business is it of yours?"
Lisa blinked innocently.
"I must have overheard it somewhere, and I was merely curious."
"One would think you might learn to tame that curiosity, seeing where it has led you."
"And while Galen was in the village," Duncan forged on, "he realized the villagers are expecting to have a celebration."
"I don't understand why you don't hear the cases. Aren't you the laird?"
Lisa pushed.
"Or are you just too busy mucking up everyone else's life and brooding all the time?"
she added sweetly. Her inactivity was getting on her nerves, and if she didn't start being mean to him, she'd end up being entirely too nice. Her resolve might not withstand another dessert with him. Duncan's laughter rang to the rafters.
It's none of your business why I dunna hear them, Sirson growled.
Fine. Nothing's any of my business, is it? What do you expect me to do? Just sit around, ask no questions, have no desires, and be a lump of spineless femininity?
You could not be spineless if you tried, Sirson said with a long-suffering sigh.
A celebration, Duncan said loudly. The villagers are planning for the feast.
What are you blathering about?
Sirson grudgingly rerouted his attention to Duncan.
If you would permit me to complete an entire sentence, you might know,
Duncan said evenly.
Well, Sirson encouraged, you have my full attention.
The villagers wish to celebrate your return and the upcoming wedding. No celebration,
Lisa said immediately.
The idea is appealing, Sirson countered.
Lisa glared at him as if he'd lost his mind.
I am not marrying you, remember? I'm not going to be here.
The three warriors turned to regard her as if she'd just informed them she would sprout wings and fly back to her time.
I will not be party to this, she snapped. A celebration might be just the thing for you, lass,
Duncan said.
And you will have the opportunity to meet your people. They are not my people, nor will they ever be,
Lisa said stiffly.
I won't be here.
With that, she turned and fled up the stairs. But she found she couldn't stay away for long. Stealthily, she crept back to the top of the stairs, fascinated by the events ongoing below. They were planning her wedding, and it was enough to boggle the mind. There they were, sprawled around the table in the great hall, and the overbearing but irresistibly sexy hunk of a Highland laird had his hands buried in fabric.
Nay, it is not soft enough. Galindria, go fetch the silk stored in the tapestry room. Adam gave me something that should suit well. Bring me the bolt of gold silk.
Duncan leaned back in his chair, his arms folded behind his head, and his boots propped on the table. The front legs of his chair hovered precariously a few inches above the floor, then hit the floor with a thump when Galen kicked the back of the chair.
What is wrong with you, Galen?
Duncan complained.
Keep your feet off the table,
Galen reprimanded.
They're dirty.
Leave him be, Galen. The table can be wiped,
Sirson said absently, fingering a pale blue wool and discarding it with a shake of his head. Duncan and Galen looked at Sirson as if he'd lost his mind.
What have we come to? Mud on the table? You, sorting through fabric? Does this mean tupping in the kitchen is now acceptable too?
Duncan asked, disbelievingly.
Far be it for me to regulate tupping, Sirson said mildly, lifting a fold of crimson velvet.
Galen snapped Duncan's mouth shut with a finger beneath his chin.
I thought you hated the gifts Adam brought you, Sirson,
Galen reminded the laird. Sirson tossed aside a pale rose linen.
Only bold colors for the lass,
he told the maids,
except perhaps lavender.
He glanced at the seamstress standing near his chair.
Have you any lavender?
At the top of the stairs, Lisa blushed. He was obviously recalling her bra and panties. The thought sent a flush of heat through her. But then her brow furrowed. Who was Adam? And why did he bring gifts? And why did Sirson hate them? She shook her head, watching him pick through the bolts spread across the table. A half dozen women were gathered around Sirson, picking up the fabrics he had approved.
A cloak from the velvet, he said, with black fur at the rim of the hood and cuffs. My colors,
he added smugly. Lisa froze, thrown off balance by the possessive note in his voice.
My colors, he'd said, but she'd clearly heard him say, my woman, and it had thrilled her.
She stepped back quickly and ducked into a corner, leaning against the wall, her heart pounding. What was she doing?
she'd been standing at the top of the stairs in the 14th century, watching him select fabric for her wedding gown. Dear God, she was completely losing herself. The immediacy of the present was so compelling, so rich and exciting, that it was eroding her ties to her real life, undermining her determination to return to her mother. She sank to the floor and closed her eyes, forcing herself to think of Catherine, to imagine what she was doing, how sick with worry she was, how alone. Lisa remained crouched on the floor, brutally forcing herself back to reality, until she felt tears sting her eyes. And then she rose, determined to take control of things for once and for all. Chapter 18. Lisa pressed back into the deep stone arch of the doorway, scarcely daring to breathe. Her feet were numb and cramped from huddling on the chilly floor. She tightened her fingers around the hilt of the knife she'd filched from the kitchen. It was a lethal blade, razor sharp, as wide as her palm and at least 12 inches long. It would serve nicely to demonstrate her point. She was through biding her time and trying patiently to find the flask. She was going to get back to the future. Now. Watching him plan her wedding gown had been the final straw. Sersin had accepted that she was going to be here forever. Worse, she had started to accept it as well. Concealing the knife in the folds of her gown, she'd slipped up to the second floor and hidden in the shadows of a doorway diagonal to Sersin's chambers, waiting for him to come up to change for dinner, as he did every night. She conceded that if she hadn't had an ill mother, she might well have embraced this experience. In her century, there were no men who could begin to compare to the masculine splendor of Sersin Brody. But Catherine needed her, and would always come first. The staircase creaked faintly, and she tensed. Peeking around the corner of the doorway, she glimpsed Sersin gliding silently down the hallway. For such a large man, he certainly moved quietly. In a moment, his back was to her. He inserted the key in the lock, and she realized the time was upon her. She would obtain the flask, no matter whom she had to go through to get it. No more passive, bewildered, susceptible to seduction, Lisa. She surged from her hiding place, pressed the tip of the blade to his back, directly in line with his heart, and commanded,
"Move! In the door, now!"
Placing her other hand at the small of his back, she pushed him forward. His spine went rigid beneath her palm.
"Now, I said, get in the room!"
Sersin kicked the door open and entered the chamber.
"Stop!"
she ordered.
"Do not turn around!"
"I saw you spying in the Great Hall, lass," he said easily. "If you don't like the gold silk, you needn't get so fussy about it. You may select your own gown. It was not my intention to offend you with my choice."
"Don't be obtuse. You know that's not what I'm upset about,"
she hissed.
"The flask, Brody. Now, get it."
She pressed the tip of her blade harder against his back to illustrate her resolve, and bit her lip when a drop of blood blossomed below his shoulder blade, spreading on the white linen of his shirt. She wished desperately that she could see his face. Was it dark with fury? Was he amused at her tenacity, or foolishly underestimating her resolve? He sighed heavily.
"For what purpose do you wish my flask? Are you in truth the traitor we feared?"
"No! I want to go home. I have no desire for your flask. I only need it to take me back."
"You still believe the flask will return you?"
"It brought me here."
"I have explained to you."
"All you've said is that it isn't the flask's power. But you won't tell me what it can do. Do you expect me to trust your word? Why should I?"
"I would not lie to you, lass. But I see that you will not believe me. Had I known you still harbored this foolish hope, I would have obliged you sooner."
He pivoted so swiftly that she fumbled, but recovered and jabbed the tip of the knife into his chest. More blood blossomed as the lethally sharpened blade slipped through his shirt as if it were butter.
"Careful with that thing, lass, unless it pleases you to ruin my shirts."
Don't move and I won't have to cut you,
she snapped. He dropped his hands to his side. I must move to collect the flask.
I'll follow you.
Nay, you will not. I will not take you to my lair.
I am the one with the knife,
she reminded him,
and it currently rests above your heart.
If he moved, she didn't see it. All she knew was that one moment she had the knife at his chest, and the next it was gone. She blinked, trying to bring the room back into focus. The blade was flush against her throat. Her eyes flared wide, and she gasped.
How did you do that?
You cannot control me, lass. No one can, he said wearily. If I give it to you, it is because I choose to give to you. And, Lisa, I would choose to give you everything, if you would but permit.
Then give me the flask,
she demanded, ignoring the cold metal at her neck.
Why do you seek it? To what do you wish to return? I have told you I will wed you and care for you. I am offering you my home.
A groan of frustration escaped her. Nothing was working out as she'd planned. He had so easily disarmed her, stripped away her control. I am offering you my home, he had said, and a treacherous part of her was deeply intrigued by that offer. She was doing it again, vacillating. She glared at him, a sheen of tears clouding her vision. At the sight of her tears, he flung the knife to the bed, where it landed with a soft thud. Pulling her into his arms, he caressed her hair tenderly.
Tell me, lass, what is it? What causes you to weep?
Lisa pulled from his embrace. Thrumming with frustration, she began pacing between him and the door.
Where is my baseball cap, anyway? Did you have to take that away from me, too?
He cocked his head.
Your baseball cap? He repeated awkwardly.
My...
What had he called it?
Bonnet.
He moved to a chest beneath a window, lifted the lid, and retrieved her clothing. Her jeans and t-shirt had been neatly folded, and atop them was her cap. She leaped toward him and snatched it greedily from his hand, clutching it to her breast. It seemed a lifetime ago that she and her father had sat in the third row, in the blue seats, directly behind home plate. They'd laughed and yelled at the baseball players, drunk sodas and eaten hot dogs drenched with mustard and relish. She'd decided that very day that she would one day marry a man just like her daddy. Charming, smart, with a fabulous sense of humor, tender, and always willing to take time for his family. Then she'd met this capable, mighty warrior, and in his shadow, the real Jack Stone had come into sharper focus, as had her real feelings about him. She was angry at her father, angry at his irresponsibility, his failure to have cars serviced, to take out life insurance, to carry adequate auto coverage, to plan for a future that might stretch beyond his present. In so many ways, her father had been an overgrown child, no matter how charming he was. But Sirsin Brody would always plan for his family's future. If he wed, he would keep his wife and children safe, no matter the cost to himself. Sirsin Brody took precautions, controlled his environment, and built an impenetrable fortress for those he called his own.
Talk to me, lass.
Lisa dragged herself from her bitter thoughts.
If you tell me why you seek so desperately to return, I will bring you the flask. Is it a man?
He asked warily.
I thought you told me there had been no one.
The tension that had quickened in her veins while she'd sat in the doorway, clutching the knife and waiting for him, dissipated suddenly. She chided herself for her foolishness,